Good afternoon. Today is April 11th, 2017. My name is Kelly Hughes, and I am here today with Elizabeth and Hans Stark. We are at their place at Raven Landing, and I want to thank them so much for allowing us to hear their story. So we'll start with a little biography information. Elizabeth, what can you tell us where and when you were born?
I was born in Fargo, North Dakota, October 5th, 1923.
Hans, how about you?
I was born in Chicago, Illinois, in Cook County Hospital on the 2nd of August, 1935.
Where did you grow up, Elizabeth? Where did you grow up?
Well, the first 8 years of my life, we lived in Portland. My parents came when I was a year old to the West Coast. And then we moved into the Willamette Valley in Oregon, where my father worked in lumber, hauling logs and things. And that's where I grew up, was in the way in the boonies.
Great. Hans, how about you? Where did you grow up?
Well, my parents went back to Germany for a visit, and they kind of got stuck over there because of World War II and not being American citizens. And so I grew up mainly in Germany. And after the war, then since I was an American citizen, I went in the service because of the drafting. I enlisted into the service, to the army. And so it's kind of confusing as far as where you grew up.
Right.
So, and that is, I mainly grew up in Germany during the war.
Okay. Can you tell us some stories about perhaps your parents or any ancestors, Elizabeth?
Well, both my parents were born in 1897. My mother went to college, which was unheard of back in those days, but she did an agriculture. And she went to the university in Fargo. And my dad, he just worked, and he was really... It just seemed like, when I think about through our life, he could do anything. He worked at so many different jobs, he could always seem to be able to master them all. And education was very important to both of them, for my two brothers and I. And we had a very close-knit family.
Thank you. Hans, how about a few stories about your own parents or your ancestors?
Oh, well, my parents, my father was actually brought up by his grandparents. And so it was kind of... And then an uncle, would be probably a grand uncle of mine. He had come to the United States, and how should I say that? Well, he came over here when he's probably about 16 years old or something like that, and. He worked over here for a while, and then he went back to go back to school. That's when he, well, actually he knew my mother before because they were living both in the same town. But that's when he met my mother and they got married. And then they both came back to the United States. So, because the family, well, religiously, they were always divided between the Protestant and the Catholic. And how should I say, my great-grandfather, actually, he was a stonemason. And then later on got into a, how should I say, dairy business. And had my grandmother, she went to school and became a nurse today we would say a registered nurse how do you call it? I can't think of the name right now.
Midwife.
Yeah, I was a midwife. And he built a house for her and for my grandmother, and it was another reason why my mother, she was homesick, and this was one of the reasons why they went back over there. It was only supposed to be a visit. And it, of course, turned out altogether different. I don't know how my father was the last of 10 or so children, but I never knew all my uncles because. I only knew one of my father's sisters and one of his brothers, and the rest of them, I don't know, that some of them might have come over here. And the family was kind of divided. I really, outside of my father and one of her aunts and one of his brothers, I didn't know any of the other uncles that I had. I think it was only the children. There was only one girl. The others were all boys. But my great grandfather. In those days he was the matriarch of the family, and because things always they're all different today, and I don't really know how to explain it. How the succession came about, because the only uncles that I knew from was my grandmother had a brother, and his family, because they lived with my great grandfather and we lived with my grandmother. things were always kind of, it took a long time before, when I grew up, to understand the succession of one side and the other.
I have something I didn't think about. I should really be telling you about this. My family would love to hear this. On my dad's side, they were his grandfather was going to make the trip, the wagon train thing where they went, you know, to settle the West. And he had married, but a brand new wife, and it was young people. And they had come North Dakota anyway. They didn't get too far until she got sick and she died. So there wasn't any children. So he just turned his wagon around and came back. And you see, where they lived, the Canadian Mandan Indians lived right into Canada, say, there. And so, and he married an Indian woman. I have pictures of her and everything. And so my grandmother then was what a half-breed would be, I think, Indian. And of course, that all came out when my brothers and I were fairly young. And so we're asking questions about this. Everybody hush, hush that up, you know. Finally, they admitted to the whole thing. And so I tell people, I got this 1/4 Indian. And they laugh at me because my mother, everybody had red hair. So that's a little tidbit in my history.
Can you tell us what brought you to Alaska?
Well, this was before I knew Hans. And my husband had a friend that was a lot older. We lived in Oregon, and he was a motor machinist. And his friend had retired, and he and his wife were going to drive the Alcan. And Larry told him, if you find anything when you get wherever you're going that you think I'd like, let me know. Well, gosh, it was several months, almost a year went by, and one day Larry came home from his job and he hadn't gotten a letter from this man. He was in Anchorage, and he says, I told him all about you because he was very good at what he did. And he said, go to Portland and see so-and-so and so-and-so. You got a job up here in Anchorage. At the same time, my parents had given me they took the National Geographic magazine, and when here the center pole, they opened it, and there was one great big picture, and here it was a picture of downtown of Anchorage, where they had the big sign, you know, All American City or something. And, that'd be wonderful. Now we had four children, but two of them were already gone away and working and all this. But the two little ones, one, Patty, was a year old. We took off, we left Oregon. He got the job. We went to Portland and he got the job. We had to be there at the first week in November or something. So here we are in October, and we had $200. We had $200, and we thought we were filthy rich. Now that's about 60 years ago, you know. So, anyhow, we made it by hook or by crook, but we made it the whole way. And there was some of the highway that wasn't paved or anything. But we got up there to Anchorage, and drove in there, and we stopped right across the street from this auto parts store where he was on, and he went in and borrowed on his first paycheck. Anyway, it all worked out very good. But unfortunately, we had another child. She was 3 years younger than Patty, and so Larry got sick and had a belated brain tumor, and we lost him. Janet was 4, that's the baby, and she lives here. She's on the board of directors here at Raven Landing. She's 56 or will be soon. Yeah. But anyway, that's how we came, 1956.
Hans, how about you? When did you come to Alaska and what brought you here?
Well, I came to Alaska with the military. I was stationed down there in the south in Alabama. And I didn't particularly like the south because of their division. I put in for overseas duty. And where did they send me? To Alaska. It was overseas. And so after I, of course, this was just before statehood. And so after I served my time in the military, I decided that a career in the military was not the best thing for me. And I got out. They had a deal going at the time, is if you had served, that it was 18 months was the tour. If you had 18 months and you had 6 months or less to do for reenlistment, if you served 3 extra months, and you could, so you got out three months early. So I decided I like this country, although it was a lot different than it is today. And so I decided to stay up here. Well, actually, while I was up here, I ran into an officer who came into the shop. His wife worked for the civil service as in civilian, and he said, "Why don't you go and see her before you get out? She might have a job for you." This is what happened. So when I got out, I had a job at civil service in Anchorage in Fort Richardson, and that's what kept me up here. Actually, the military brought me up here. I liked the country, and so I stayed up here.
Did you work long at that job, for the civil service job?
For about close to 2 years.
Well, tell them what you did.
Yeah, what was your career?
What do you mean, my career? I was an electrician. But see, I went to, when I was over there in Germany, I served an apprenticeship as an electrician. So when I went into the service through the selective service system in those days, I was 1A, which was you were right up for the draft, and I decided I was a journeyman by then. I could not get a job because I had the service facing the service, so I couldn't go under contract anywhere. So I decided to enlist into the service. Well, it wound up, I served 6 years in there. And I think that maybe because I had a profession, the service never was, I could never believe everything that they told you, that, you know, like 3 squares and a, and so I got out of the service. I figured I can do as good outside of the services. And so that's where when I was in the service, they classified me as a motor and generator repairman. And I never went to school, not into a military school. They told me, oh, you don't need to go into school. You already know more than they ever will teach you in the school. So that's what they, in the military, they call it an MOS. So when I got out of this, I worked for a while there for civil service, what they called in those days off-base facilities. That is, you traveled to all your ACMW sites here did maintenance and repairs and upgrades on these. Yeah. So it was not, I say it was more, I was too young to actually work on base on a, this was too mundane. But going there and on off base working for off base facilities, that was always it was more interesting. And after a while, I run into some guys that. On these trips those off-base facilities, and I decided that maybe I can get a job in the civilian sector, and I did, and I finally joined the union, but in those days. It wasn't like you didn't work all. If you worked construction, you didn't work all year long. You worked through the season, and in the winter time they usually shut down. Later on, then when they came up with the plastics and stuff like that, where you could close in and work here, and then they worked all year long. But in those days, you had to make it when the work was there, you know. And then a lot of guys that you get what they used to call for the miners, and so the gold, you know, the miners, a crop stake, you know, for them, take you through the winter and then work in the summertime, you pay it off. So actually, he was always, you made good money in one respect, but since you didn't work all year long with it, the good money you make in the summertime, you paid back in the winter, you know. So, but things changed then later on. Of course, the whole country changed when Lesser became a state, I remember when I came up here in the military, it was in the winter time, and the airport in Anchorage, it was not but a big building, and there were no ramps or anything like that. You got off the plane on a ladder, and that was that winter was they come to pick us up in a bus. You sit in the bus and you couldn't look over the snowbanks, you know. So.
Well, gosh, when I was first up here, the airplane from Anchorage is, like you said, one building. And when they called the flight, you were going to be going on, you'd walk out on the tarmac and climb the, up into the plane. There wasn't any, nothing like it is now, of course.
So did you, what did you do for work? Or were you?
Well, I was mostly a stay-at-home mom. I worked piddly. Not, well, when the girls were in high school. Well, maybe grade school. I worked piddly little stuff. Nothing to write home about. But then after they were, Janet was in college and Patty was married, and then I was by myself all the time. Because when he'd go on a job, he'd always be running the job and he'd be gone for 3 months at a time. So I didn't bother me any that he would be gone like that, but he finally said to me, you know, up here, he said, you know, this place where I rent movies, they probably could leave you there. So I went, and sure enough, I cleaned. Then they taught me, there's a man and his wife. They're no more. They've been gone a long time now. But anyway, I worked and I learned how to run a computer, kind of. And about the movies that you rent, you know, that sort of thing. But I never owned a mop. My adult life, I did my floors on my hands and knees. Things like that, you know, that so many people here that are my up as I'll be 94 in October, and they're in their 90s, and their lives are similar, you know. So
I have to ask. So now, how did you two end up being together?
I used to work with a guy that I knew when I was working for the civil service. That he and his wife knew Elizabeth. And one night I came into town and they introduced us, actually. That's how we met through friends of hers.
Mm-hmm. And you've been married a long time?
50 years.
50 years, wow, wow. So how many kids?
I had four.
You had four kids.
I lost one of the ones that came, that he raised. He raised the last two. Mm-hmm. And because Patty was six and Janet was four when he married me. And he had never been married and he didn't have any kids of his own. So I've always told anybody that asked me about things like this, he did just such a beautiful job. Like if they were naughty or did things they weren't supposed to do, he never shouted at them or spanked and did all that. He would settle down and he would talk to them very calmly and quietly. And Janet, our baby, lives here, yeah, she has always said she doesn't even remember her dad. She goes, Mother, he's my dad. And Patty was the same way. He did so much for me. 1 year he bought him skis and we lived in Anchorage. He built us a beautiful big home we had down there. But he used that because I didn't have nothing to do with the skiing, so he'd take them on a Sunday with a backpack with a lunch, and away they'd go. We lived at the foot of the Chugach Range down there, so they'd go skiing when he would be home, you know. And my life changed completely from what it had been. So
she's talking about a home in Anchorage. This was a 4-bedroom home. We paid something like $38,000 for it. at the time. You can't even buy a car for that anymore.
Right. Oh, wow.
Well, yeah, he had it built. I got to go out there, and when they were building it, and I've never done anything like this in my life, and pick out the paneling in the dining room and this and that. Oh, God, it was wonderful.
Oh, fun. What are some of your fondest memories?
Fond from up here?
Yeah, or from, yeah, just maybe, I don't know, maybe growing up or just something that when you think about, those were some fond times, I guess.
Well, we had a lot of good memories here. After, listen, I got married, we go out, with the kids go out camping, you know. We used to start, we, in those days, we still lived down in Anchorage. And for a time, I worked on the offshore platforms in Cook Inlet. She used to pick us up, and we go, and this was long before they ever built that highway here between, when you still had to go on the old highway, and then when you go to Fairbanks, then you had to cross over from, was it Delta?
Yeah.
And anyway, we go go camping. It's just, we had an old stack tent, you know, and stuff. And so, and I bought the kids a 22, and so we go out. It was just a single shot. I'd go out plinking, you know, in those days they were. And that's what, and go fishing, you know, and camping when we could all. That was some of the most fond memories that we had.
How about you, Elizabeth?
Oh, yes. I've been thinking about that since I knew about it. It had to be. It had to be raising those kids. It was when we would go on these camping trips. We had our car was a
Chrysler.
Big Chrysler. And that trunk, my gosh, you could load up everything in the kitchen in that trunk of that car. But anyway, we had a tent. It was just like an igloo. And
it wasn't either. It was a stack, an old top can. But it did have a bottom in it.
So we had sleeping bags, and we were in there like corbels with the four of us. And we always had a dog, and we always took the dog with us. One point, he was as big. And, that for me, too, was all those times when we used to go like that, and we had so much fun. And then when, well, true, then the grandkids. And Kamwani, Patty married a Hawaiian. And so her firstborn, he's 42 years old now, but he's left-handed and he taught in our Quartz Lake how to fly fish. Nobody else could do it because they weren't left-handed. They couldn't do it that way. So
I had to learn to teach it myself because in those days they didn't have. If you were a lefty, you know, you were just left out. You know, there were no left. If you were lefty, you wanted to play baseball. You couldn't get a glove or anything, you know. And I taught myself I read some books, but it was all for right-handed people. And so I had to figure out how to do it left-handed, you know. And for me, it was easier to teach him because he was left-handed. And so we had a lot of fun teaching him. And but the outdoors up here, that was the primary thing.
Is that his full name?
Yep. It's my son gave me this on my birthday last year. And this, I was the oldest of three of us. We lost him in 2009. But this one's an Episcopal priest. We call him the Pope.
Oh, funny. Nice.
He's still religious and all that, and his whole congregation.
Mm-hmm.
I told him, I don't go to church anymore. And he says, that's all right, I've got your back.
You're funny.
Right.
So, go ahead.
Well, you know, because when I was then got to work with for civilian or contractors and so. I was on the first. Working on the first atomic test out there in Amchitka.
Mm-hmm.
That was a military, joint military, and well, there was the Livermore laboratories and that. It was just a calibration test, because in those days they used to say that they was going to use like an atomic bomb to build a submarine base here. So this was another one of those pipe dreams that they went around. But I was on that air. I was a foreman there, and the cabling foreman. And then I was on one of the regular tests, an underground test, for about a mile. It was about a mile underground. And from then on, because on the pipeline,
They investigated me and my whole family for that cannequin that was out on the chain when he thrown out down in Mile Hill. And of course, I didn't know what it was he was doing. He couldn't tell me that. And I don't remember how long they're gone, but he couldn't. And then, when the paychecks started coming, in those days, they didn't take any tax out of any hazardous, like they didn't take any taxes out of the paychecks.
It was because it was hazardous duty. It was, it went down in a shaft for the excavation. Well, we had to go down there because they had dewatering pumps that when they drilled that shaft, that they hit some fissures, water, underground water things, and some of it were under pressure, and some of them they could stem with French grout and stuff like that. But anyway, they had to pump this water out so it wouldn't flood. And every so often they had to change pumps to go down, and they were actually the pumps, they call them Rita pumps, and they were initially for the oil companies developed them. They were stacked pumps, but to go down there, the most conditions, I mean, the best conditions that we have had was about 128 to 134 degrees. So you you dehydrated real fast, so you had to watch yourself. And you eat the salt the tablets, what a handful. But this, that's why in those days this was considered a hazardous to the, and in those days it was, they weren't taxed on that. Wow. So you had, we were working 12-hour shifts, and you spend about 6-8 hours downhole. And of course, then you could have to, when you come up, you have to clean up, you have to take a shower, and I mean, it's so wet down there, and so you have a wore is gum boots, pair of pants, and a slinger. But you made a lot of money. You know, with more time you spend down hole, the more money.
Was it on Shimia?
Was. No, this was in Amchitka.
Oh.
When I went, at first, I used to go the whole loose and chain, especially when I worked for civil service, all the way from Anchorage to Shimia. It's going to from Anchorage to Cold Bay and then on out to Shimia. And because they had stations all along there on those islands. I was out there one time, we had a storm out there in Shimia, and there was an outfit that's called Reeves Aleutian Airlines. And they serviced, they went from, went all the way down. It took about, a good eight hours to go from Anchorage if you had to work out there. And I spent quite a bit of time out there because their power requirements increased over the year. And initially they had a power plant that was built by General Electric, and that wasn't sufficient anymore, so you had to add generators to that. And so I went out there twice to put more capacity, to increase the capacity, power capacity. And one time we went out there, and we had a storm out there. They have fuel barges there, and this Shimia is where, between Shimia and, was it Attu? Yeah, and Attu. There's a riptide in there because there is the North Pacific and the Arctic Oceans. They come together there. And they have big storage capacity for fuel, because they have a barge come out. And they pump off fuel for the whole year supply. They had one of the barges went to ground, and it knocked a big hole, and they tried to keep it from slipping away. They had a couple of dead cats up there and had tied onto it, and then they tried to pump because it went on the rocks and it had a big hole in the bottom. But these barges, they're compartmentalized. And so whatever was in the compartments, they were good. They tried to pump that off in that storm. One time they had that. Of course, in the beginning, they used to have, there was some airline that went to Japan, and they used Shimia as an overnight stop. They had a hotel there. Northwest Orient Airlines. So they had a big storm, and the pilots down there on they had to get into the plane and run the plane into the wind, tie it down and run the plane into wind to keep it from the wind from blowing it, from blowing their way.
Well, so yeah, there were some. We got one more question.
Right, well, two more. So what brought you to Raven Landing?
Yeah.
What brought you to Raven Landing, Elizabeth?
We had gone down.
We
were with Patty down our garter. And I had always really wanted, I didn't like the big city and all that, and I was wanting to come back here, but I don't know, we just didn't stay with her. And so, unfortunately, she died just like that in my arms, her heart. And Janet, and I know Patty's kids lived up here with their, you know, they're all grown adults. And boy, everybody came and we had a memorial and we're going, thank God. And I thought, it just was one of those things where I didn't really care what happened from then on. That was the most powerful thing. I'd lost family before, of course, but this losing a child is without a doubt the worst thing that ever happened to you. So anyway, we're coming back, and that Kalani, his wife, she's one of these kind of gals that there's nothing she can't do. She's just weird. She would get a U-Haul, all drive it, load all your furniture, everything, put a trailer on the back and your car on there, and I'll drive it up because Kamalani had already been gone long enough from his job. So while we got all situated, and I'd get to get out of there down in Whittier, which is part of Los Angeles. So that's how we came back, and they told us about this place, and of course I knew where it was. I said, the ghetto? So anyhow, when we came, and they'd already been here, I just couldn't ask for anything any better than this. It's just wonderful. It's like one big family, and I run into some people here now. And if there's something wrong with somebody, you help out. And I'm doing that all the time. And we just really like it here.
But it was actually the death of our daughter that brought us back here. Yeah. And Janet, they found this place here before, and they got an apartment. Actually, it was the other apartment that they had before, and then I don't know what made them change it. This is how we got here.
How long have you been living at Raven?
I've been here 5 years in July.
Okay. And the last really fun question is, what has been so far your favorite age?
Oh, God. Oh, brother, I don't know. I'm just going to say now.
Hans, how about you?
Well, a favorite age, I don't know. When you were still working, I don't know, maybe in the 30s or something like that, when the kids were still small. Because then you had a lot of good... You had activities that you can't do anymore today, so I'd say in the 30s.
Well, thank you so much for telling us your story and putting it so it can be archived. I think that will be fun for people to be able to go back and listen to. And know our parents' stories. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Do you still have your